The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Make a plan to do away with high-interest credit card debt by transferring your balance to a Navy Federal credit card. With a low intro APR and no balance transfer fees, you could pick the right card to help you save more. Check out NavyFederal.org for more information.
Team Never Quit Radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. If you guys aren't already following us on YouTube, you should be because we're doing video now, and that's fun. Patreon question, guys. Got a Patreon question. It's going to be a little more chill than the last question. Rebecca.
What's up?
What is one object from your childhood that you still have today?
My baby blanket. My whoobie.
Your whoobie. You still use it? Or is it just like in a box, or is it somewhere on your couch?
That is none of your business.
That's none of your damn business, mister.
Yeah, my whoobie. Still got it.
So still have the whoobie. I have my Transformers from when I was a boy. G.I. Joe. You want me to keep going?
Yeah, go. Bring it on. You got it all.
No, there was a couple of nostalgic toys that we had. Because we didn't have much. I would always put my we didn't even know this was a thing, but I would put my toys back in the box when I was done playing with them. Is that squared away now? That's pretty squared away, isn't it? Uh-huh. And it's cool to look at that.
That's pretty cool. We should have kept my
comics and sports cards. I kept them all this time, dragged them all over the country, drove them back and forth in Pelican cases. And I'm supposed to give them to my boys. I got two boys, 12 and 14. I haven't given them to them yet.
What's your most expensive card?
I got a Jerry Rice rookie card for like 2 cents. You know, that's worth probably $1,000.
Man.
Or so. Yeah.
Jay Rice. Yeah. Hold on to that bad boy.
Yeah. I got a ton of cards. You know, Bo Jackson. Remember Bo Jackson?
Of course, yeah. Of course.
Dude, if he
would have reason the Kansas City uniform,
I've got them all. I've got like 50 of his rookie cards.
When he ran up that wall,
they're not worth much because he's not going to the Hall of Fame. He got hurt.
Yeah, amazingly enough,
everyone knows that Bo knows that he should be in the Hall of Fame. That dude,
he dominated.
Broke his own leg. So they were holding, trying to tackle him, and he broke his own hip.
Nice. Yeah, separated his that.
And when he ran up that fence and caught that ball, that documentary on him is amazing.
Baseball from home plate over the center field wall.
Sure he did.
It's hard enough to dominate in one sport. That dude dominated in two sports.
He did.
Two professional
sports. But that's right when we were coming into the age of sports, too. That was back, Jordan, all of them. That was a great time, man.
I got that card, too. Jordan holding the baseball bat over his shoulders. White Sox.
I watched the dance. Last Dance.
The Last Dance, good.
Amazing. Amazing.
Rebecca, thanks for the question. It's always nice to reminisce a little bit.
Did you see that it's like Strange Inheritance series?
No.
This lady was emptying her aunt's attic out and threw a shoebox down on the table downstairs for like a week. It was the last thing they walked out of the house. 10, 20 perfect sets of the very first baseball cards. Honus Wagner. Pristine. Tens. They do it in 1 to 10, right?
I think so. Grading,
all
yeah.
of every set was worth millions.
Crazy.
And she had like 20 of them.
And almost threw them away.
Almost threw them away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were wrapped up in handkerchiefs. Amazing.
That'd be a cool find.
That'd be such a cool find.
I guess Gary Vaynerchuk has been talking about cards forever, and I think they're starting to come back.
Oh, Gary V.
I still have the rest of them, too. Remember the first Astros game we ever went to? I still have those.
Oh, yeah. And that little book they gave us?
It still smells like the... That was a cool part when you opened up the baseball cards and the way that...
Bubblegum?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Hey, guys, we have got a great guest in store today. Monty Heath joined the U.S. Navy in 1993 to become a SEAL. He proudly served his country for 11 years. During this time, he was deployed to multiple war zones and was twice awarded the Bronze Star with Combat Valor designation. After honorably discharging in 2004, he led the U.S. Navy SEALs Mentorship Program and the BUDS Preparatory Program, the first two steps in the SEAL candidates' training pipeline. Welcome to the show, Monty.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The long flight from where it's nice and chilly all the time, right? Where are you hanging your hat these days?
Virginia Beach.
Yeah?
I was in Idaho for like 5 years, but just got back to Virginia Beach. The in-laws successfully petitioned to get us back.
They're good at that.
They're good, and I lucked out with them.
You did. Yeah. Say, solid people.
Yeah, I love them.
How could you not?
I can't imagine having in-laws that are terrible, you know?
I don't want to ever lose them. No matter what, I want to lose them.
Before we jump into the weeds about it, you never quit story, can you give us a little background on who, just tell us where from, how to, and what you do, give us kind of overview of what's going on right now.
Yeah, grew up in New England, very strange family, lots of anger, lots of, I don't say lots of violence, but a good amount of violence, chaos. Didn't know what I wanted to be until I saw Navy SEALs, right? I still have the VHS cassette. That was the deal. I was like, that's what I'm doing. That's the only thing I'm doing. No plan B. Went to BUDS.
What scene was it?
Ooh.
And I know the whole thing is a good, I mean, from when that song comes on the golf course deal, freaking.
Maybe jumping off the bridge.
The bridge, right?
Right.
I wanted to do that till you got up on Coronado Bridge and realized how high that was.
Was it Coronado Bridge? I think bridge. Windhaven Bridge.
Windhaven Bridge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is doable. Well,
I was trying to be tough and jump off
Coronado's not people that's who jump 200 off, feet.
They get stuck.
Yeah.
That is a kick-ass moment. That whole scene, right? It's just like, that's what I want to do.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. It was the only thing I wanted to do.
It's the only thing that can get you out of a wedding up on the altar.
If you said that you jumped off a bridge.
No. If the beeper goes off and you're a Navy SEAL. It's the only thing.
All right, anyway.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about that time frame right before going to BUDS is I was on the swim team and never put forth much effort into any of the sports I played because I had a effed up, you know, home life, I suppose. That's my excuse anyway. But I started to excel in swimming in my senior year of high school, was undefeated, set in school records, but I was still like a punk-ass bitch, loud, you know, talker, let my mouth get in the way sometimes. And I failed gym class. Like, how do you fail gym class?
Lots of people do that.
You don't show up.
That's a coach.
You don't play kickball. Yeah, right. You call Mr. Gutterson, gutter joke, the red nose boozer. And all of a sudden you fail gym class. And I got thrown off the swim team like right before the state championships. So in my undefeated season, setting records, I got thrown off the swim team and didn't get to go to the state championships. And that was like the first time in my life where I realized, wow, like if I want something, I have to put 100% into it. I can't just half-ass what I want, which is a good lesson because a couple months later I went to BUDS. And who knows how I would have done in BUDS if I didn't kind of get that lesson of like, hey man, you're like, you need to be 100% in what you want to do or it's not going to happen for you. You know? So anyway, go to BUDS. Didn't make it straight through. Was there?
No, I was hoping you did.
Three classes? No, man. I was there for a year.
God.
At 18 years old, I showed up at 18. I spent my 19th birthday there. So I was a year. Picture like 1/18 of my life was in BUDS, right? That's crazy.
So let me ask you a question. Because a lot of guys in our community have that attitude when they're younger in high school. And then you get to once you step into the program, though, you didn't have that. Like the day one, week one at BUDS, that kind of goes away. Is that because of what's walking around in there?
In terms of what goes away? In terms of
that,
the attitude?
That punk attitude.
Oh, because you get your ass beat. You know,
that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
When you walk into a stable where there's something bigger and badder than you in there, it's kind of like, I don't care how bad you thought you were out there. When you walked in, it's not that.
No. You want to be gray. You want to slide.
I didn't have that opportunity. Yeah, I think it's a source. That's a great point because most guys but a large number of guys that seem like they enter into this program, our backgrounds are the same. Is that punk ass kid that didn't have any manners and somehow either go to jail or go to the Navy or just to have anything else to do, landed in that program, turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to him.
I was an angry kid, and you guys know the only emotion that really is accepted and encouraged in the SEAL teams is anger. Right? Yeah. And that's perfect place to be. So
get showed up for that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all had, I don't know how you would make it through without any anger or be in that profession if you didn't have a good source of anger, you know? So I made it through BUDS. This is all pre-war, 93, 94. East Coast, 18 Delta, second to last.
Another Delta guy. Class. Man, you guys are like.
We didn't get pigs or goats, though. I was the short course, in Fort Sam Houston.
You're in Texas though.
Texas, yeah.
In San Antonio, that's why I signed up. They're like, "Hey, what do you want to do?" I was like, "Well, was there any schools in Texas?" And like that 18 Delta, I didn't know what it was. And instead of medic, and I wanted to be a medic actually, and I was like, "Oh, that's even better." And you got to go straight to Buds, which I thought was, "Oh, that's really cool." Until you, you know, until you go to Buds and you realize it's not.
Wait, did you go to 18 Delta before Buds?
No, after.
Okay, okay, yeah,
after. I was a striker in Buds, which is they didn't tell you that either. You're undesignated. I was the guy they would always point to the ship. He's like, "Hey, Latrell, you see that ship out there? Yeah. You're not even going to be doing the flapjack thing. You're going to be chipping the paint stuff." Yeah. Undesignated. They just called up. They want you. That kind of thing.
So I actually cross-rated out of Corpsman pre-war, so never got to do any Corpsman stuff anymore. I went to IT. Because they told me, like, I wanted to go to Team 6, and they told me you've got to do long course and then, like, 1 to 2 years as an instructor even before you can put your package in. I'm like, no, hell no.
Jesus.
So cross-rated over to IT. Information tech, yeah. Okay. It was a joining of RM and ET.
All right.
No test. Like, I was in HM1 one day and IT1 the next day.
Oh, your first class?
Oh, you were first class?
Yeah.
Damn, buddy.
Yeah.
So what'd you go into Buds as?
I was die fare, right? So I was delayed entry program, die fare.
E4, that's right.
So I got E4 out of Buds.
That's right.
E5 was pretty easy, and then E6 was a bitch. And then right when I left, I was chief eligible. So if I stayed in like a couple more months, I would have made E7. The cool thing, though, about this pre-war stuff is I got over to Bosnia, and we were doing PIFWICs, right? Persons indicted for war crime, taking them up to The Hague to stand trial against humanity. But other guys were wrapping them up. And I was like, "Well, who are those guys?" And they're like, "Well, that's SEAL Team 6. And I was like, "Oh, interesting. That's where I want to go." So fast forward, all my years later, 2 weeks before I got out of the teams, I went back to Bosnia, and we got to do a full soup to nuts, surveillance and wrap up of this dude. I was the primary prisoner handler. I got to rip this asshole out of his house that raped like 200 women and killed 100 guys.
Jesus.
And got out of the Navy 2 weeks later. So everything I wanted to do was like complete.
Just like that.
Just like that. So I guess back up a little bit, went over to NSWDG, was in Green Team when the towers fell in 01. So
perfect timing.
Another group of guys went over there first. We got over there second and got over there the winners of 02, 03, and 04. So you'll probably pop up Neil Roberts, if you want to pop that up right there. First SEAL to die in Afghanistan, Roberts Ridge. I was there. I didn't do anything. I was the last helo to go in. And when we went in, we just set up shop and loaded the 7 bodies. You know, bad day. But I went to his wedding, did a platoon with him at SEAL Team 2. Great mofo. You guys probably know the guy on the side there, Ollie.
Taking a hit.
And
I know him.
Did you guys ever meet Neil?
I never did.
Great mofo. Funny. And Roberts Ridge, first SEAL to die in Afghanistan. Bad day.
I remember him well. I didn't know him.
Yeah. We lost Chappie, a CCT guy, and a bunch of air crew. And, you know, I don't know what you guys know about that op, but it was like 14,000 feet, Tacker Gar. And we asked the agency, like, do a flyover and tell us what's going on that mountaintop. And they came back too quickly and said nothing, right? There's no movement. Well, come to find out, there were thousands of boot prints in the snow, and if they had looked at the correct mountaintop, they would have seen that, and they would have known that our guys were literally flying into an ambush. So the first 47 that went in, they got ambushed. They got lit up. He either jumped out or fell out, and then they took off, and they crash-landed a couple miles away. Britt Zabinski, you know, who was awarded the Medal of Honor, is like, "We're getting another bird in there." And they're like, "I don't know if we're getting another bird in there." He's like, "We're getting another bird in there." They have to fight their way uphill, right? Like, the last thing on the planet you want to do is fight uphill, and you know, and it was just a bad day. It was a horrible day.
So, but the PJ on that op, Jason Cunningham,
yeah,
he was my I was an 18 Delta with him. So we were buddies. He was brand new.
Yeah, crazy. The interesting thing about it, or, you know, that was kind of where we felt like we weren't invincible anymore, right? Like,
amazing how that happens.
We got over in January. We're kicking ass in January, February, March. And I think that was March 4th. And then we're like, wow, you know, we can actually die. Like, people are actually dying. And then you got to go back to work, right? You know, it's not easy to have a bunch, seven of your buddies die, and then you got to go back to work. Like, this deployment's not over. Yeah.
So, very active career, good career, even though I think some people kind of raise their eyebrow when you say you had an amazing career and there's so much tragedy going on. But that's what we signed up for. Not much tragedy, just know to understand what was going to happen. Got out of the service. What's next?
I started a business with some team guys and some other military people, learned a lot. It kind of failed, you know. We didn't get funding right. We were spending too much money. Learned a lot from that failure. Then went into defense contracting, did that for like 4 or 5 years, learned business and learned contracts and costs and fixed costs and variable costs and all that kind of stuff. My transition didn't really start yet because that was like a team guy centric company. So I was around my buddies and, you know, Virginia Beach, it didn't leave. So I didn't really transition yet. And then I went out west and I went to a 624,000 acre eco resort and ran that for a year. That was a nonprofit dealing with wild Mustangs.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah. And that's sort of where my life changed, not because of that, but because of what I was doing on the side. So I was basically a ski bum. I got to be a ski bum because it was a summer deal. And I started working as a Special Olympic ski instructor. And I think that's where, no, I don't think, that's where humanity was like entered into my life. Like I didn't want to be a corpsman. I wanted to be a corpsman first, but I didn't want to help people. Like I wanted to hurt people, yeah. Right? That's why I cross-rated out of it. And until I started working, here, you pull up the, right there, Maria, Down syndrome. You know, all my friends were SEALs. All my friends were cool. We're all like good looking, fit dudes. But what about her? Like, what about somebody that's born with Down syndrome? Like, we live these privileged, badass lives, but there's people that are born with severe cognitive disabilities and everything else. And I started to get some humility into my life. Like, shocker, I didn't leave the teams with any humility, you know? Amazing. But that's where I got it, right there. So,
I mean, that's got to be a smile that just lights up your. Right when you walk in the door.
Right. Right. And she was hard. She was hard to deal with. But, you know, I took her skiing all the time and it got better and better and better. And it chipped away, you know, it chipped away at my arrogance and it installed humility.
So you said earlier, which was right on point, that you have to have anger in your life, yeah, in order to make it through and do and accomplish what we do in our community, especially in a time of war. And I think there's a big misnomer, misconception that you can just check that shit at the door when you step out. That's not how it is. Most people in the world walk around happy, and every once in a while they're angry. Guys in our profession walk around angry 24/7, and then occasionally you're happy.
Yes.
And you're fortunate enough, and I had this happen to me too, but fortunate enough to have that walk into your life, and it's almost a slap in the face where there's a realization or an epiphany where you're like, I don't have to be that way. And here's the prime example why.
Yeah. So I quickly went from this to veterans. So I started working for this organization called Higher Ground, and it's veterans with PTSD, TBI, and military sexual trauma. And I think sort of like as a penance or as a punishment to myself, I didn't want to go work with the super cool guy organizations. Like I didn't want to be with the Navy SEALs or Spec War or any of that. I wanted to be like with the common people and just common soldiers. And I, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I was so sick of myself and sick of that kind of team guy arrogance that I wanted to work with everybody else. So I started working with folks with PTSD, TBI, and military sexual trauma was a big one and a
That's
strange
a very
one
for- hidden. Black over behind the veil problem.
So 1 in 100 men, mm-hmm, in the service claim military sexual trauma. 1 in 100 dudes and 1 in 5 women claim military sexual trauma. Now it's not like full blown rape, but some type of sexual misconduct.
Harassment.
That's not right. Cool. And it changed me. Like I started to talk with women that were raped multiple times and like get into it and like then talking about like how it happened and why it happened. And I would say like, how do you not hate men? Like, how do you trust men still? Like, you know, the last woman I talked to, she was raped 3 separate times in 3 separate you know, completely unconnected. And I'm like, how do you trust males? Like, how do you trust? And she was like, most men aren't rapists. You know, I had some bad things happen to me, but I don't let it cloud the rest of my life. And I was like, wow, you know,
amazing.
Total perspective shift. And so, you know, learned a lot about the brain, and I know that's your specialty. And I got really into it. And, you know, why do people act the way they do with TBIs? You know, what is the brain? How it is affected? Is it physically affected? Like, some people think like PTSD is not a thing. It's actually, they're all traumatic brain injuries. Like, you physically affect and change your brain when you experience trauma, you know, and all that kind of stuff. It was quite interesting to me. And recreational therapy was interesting to me. That's what Higher Ground does. And that basically what that is just do something and then talk about it later. Doesn't matter if it's fly fishing or skiing or whitewater rafting or equine therapy, whatever the heck it is. You're in the moment. You're doing something. You're not thinking about all the shit that you've experienced in your life, whether it's childhood trauma or war trauma. You're just in the moment and you're in the zone. And there's something to that. And then later you kind of talk about it. And most people are uncomfortable about talking about things, but if you are uncomfortable, it means you're doing it right. Like, you know, our whole society is nowadays is all about like never being uncomfortable.
Never taking yourself out of your comfort zone.
But there's no growth in the comfort zone. Like, that's not just a stupid phrase. It's real. Like, we have to be uncomfortable to grow and evolve. And that's my down and dirty and what I've been doing.
So yeah, given your where you come from, a challenging childhood, which people can relate to that. People, even if they haven't had it, they understand it. Then entering into the Navy, going into the teams, serving your country honorably for a little over a decade, and then exiting, circling back, taking care of those who we fought alongside, plus the ones we fought with. But that's not your never quit story that you wanted to talk about today. I think, and I'm excited. It breaks my heart. I mean, it's because I know you and I know your son. It breaks my heart to hear, but I would love for you to share that with us if you...
Yeah. Yeah, pull up. So that's George. This happened last May. And so on the weekend, he's like, you know, I've got a really bad headache. And we're like, okay, so we'll schedule an appointment for Monday.
And how old is he at this point?
He's 11. And so schedule the appointment. The next day he wakes up and he goes, my whole spine hurts. We're like, holy shit. So
how does an 11-year-old know how to say that unless it is actually rocking?
So we were like, okay, let's go to the ER. So we go to the ER. This is in Idaho. And, you know, they start to look at him. They can't really find anything. He starts to degrade. So we're now in the hospital and we're not leaving. And he starts to degrade. Like he's unconsciously screaming. Like he's screaming in pain, but he's not conscious. He's starting to... you know, to lose responsiveness. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they do a check for bacterial meningitis, right? Yeah. So they know that he has spinal meningitis at this point, but they say it's viral. And I'm like, okay, cool. Viral doesn't kill you. Bacterial does. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, he's degrading. He slips into a coma. And then on Friday, while he's in a coma, they're like, we actually found a bacteria, this mycoplasma bacteria. It's bacterial. We're like, fuck. So unfortunately, he's not in the ICU or the PICU, the pediatric ICU, which is a whole nother topic, and he should have been. But he's not in the PICU, and he's not getting much care. My wife and I are in there 24/7, and like, I'm suctioning him. Like, he's just producing all this mucus. I'm suctioning his nose. I'm suctioning his mouth. He's starting to gurgle a lot, right? And
he wasn't intubated this time.
He wasn't intubated yet. And so on that Friday, my wife and I are the only ones in the room. He fucking codes and he stops breathing. And I don't remember. I was sitting on the bench and I kind of just felt something. So I got up and I stood over him, and he stopped breathing. I see his freaking, you know, the breathing reads zero, and his pulse is going crazy. And I look at him, I squeeze some juice out of his mouth, some more mucus. I turn his head over and squeeze out some more, but I'm like, you know, do I start rescue breathing on this dude? Like, do I want to push more of this fluid down into his lungs? My wife runs off and she's screaming to get doctors in there. I look around the room, like I don't see an ambu bag. I don't see any equipment whatsoever. I've got like nothing to do. I'm standing here with my son in my hands that's dying. Finally, the crew starts coming in. I hear Code Blue come over the hospital, and the crash team comes in. They bring an ambu bag and they're all like fucking with it, and they're like not getting it together quickly. I'm like, dude, hurry up! He's turning blue. They finally get a bag into him, and he starts. His vitals get better, but that was the start of like a 51-day ride. Where he was in a coma for about a week and a half, completely unresponsive, slow brain waves. At one point, they drilled into his skull and put here's something I didn't know. When you get like a brain drain, they drill into your skull and they put a straw down into your brain. Like it's not just like drill a hole in your skull and like that's where the pressure's coming out. No, they put a straw down into the inactive part of his brain. So until we got that going, we didn't know that his intracranial pressure was so bad. So this is what sucks. The week he got there, like Monday through Friday, and he's starting to go unconscious and he's screaming, like the intracranial pressure was just building. And he's screaming because his brain is being destroyed. So 50% of his cerebellum was destroyed, and a little spot on his brainstem, which was the most significant, the worst, was destroyed. And so anyway, fast forward a week and a half later, he starts to come out of it. He comes out of it. His arms are useless, like he's paralyzed. The only thing he can do is blink. So we start communicating with him with blinks, like, hey, blink twice for yes, one for no. Right. And we're communicating that way. That's about a week. And then, then his fingers start to kind of work. And we're like, we have like an alphabet. And he's starting to be able to like point to letters, right? Check this out. The first thing he spelled out letter by letter was, I want a sandwich. The second thing he spelled out letter by letter was, to my wife, you and dad complete each other. How about that? My wife is super emotional, super creative, cries and bawls at everything. I'm like stoic, not much affects me. She's super loving and nurturing, and I'm like, I'm who you want, like when shit gets bad. And there's this 11-year-old that wakes up from death and is like, you and dad complete each other.
Jerry Maguire just coming out of the...
Did you put it on the TV? Like, hey,
God almighty. I mean, I can't imagine. But so my baby, when he was born, went straight to the ICU for 2 weeks. Just wires tapped, looked similar to that right there. And you and I were chatting about this a little earlier. Coming from a background where there's no such thing as... kind of like perceptual agony, or because we were like you said, we were invincible. They don't have those problems in our world. Can you kind of lend some perspective of what this did to you? Just so there's thousands and thousands of us out there.
So the first thing it did was I felt useless, right? So here's my boy in my hands. And I don't usually feel useless. Like we're not useless type people. And I felt completely useless. And I couldn't save him. I couldn't help him. And the first thought that I had was, if he dies, I die. Mm-hmm. And then a louder, stronger voice in my head was like, no, you have another boy. You know, he needs you. So knock that shit off. And then gratitude. I didn't understand gratitude until this. I just didn't. Like, we even taught it at Higher Ground, but I didn't understand it. I didn't have gratitude in my heart. I wasn't grateful for anything. It goes back to that kind of anger piece, right? So now I have gratitude for him, and I didn't even really connect with him. So I have two boys. My older boy is kind of like a team guy. This guy was like very cerebral and intellectual and reads a lot. And like my older boy's like a team guy, and he was just kind of whiny, and I don't know. I didn't really connect with him. And this occurred, and now we're tight as tight can be. I learned gratitude, and I became tight with a son that I didn't really relate to before. So it's
amazing.
It's been good. Yeah,
the small stuff you probably took for granted that you don't anymore.
Oh yeah, yeah. Just the idea of waking up in the morning and just stating or writing like what you're grateful for can be a life changer.
That's something you do for
that's something I do, and I didn't even think about doing before. And it puts you in the right mindset. Like I would say gratitude and attitude are like a seesaw, right? Like if your gratitude is high, you can't have a bad attitude. But if you have no gratitude, you've got a bad attitude. You know, that's how I was.
I've never heard it put that way. That's
right.
That's the seesaw, the teeter-totter.
Yeah. Inversely, what is it? Inversely proportional relationship.
So 51 days was this?
51 days in the ICU, or 51 days total. We went to Salt Lake City, which was an inpatient neuro rehab program. And I thought we were going to be there forever. Like, I had no idea how long we were going to be there. But he came around quick, and we were only there for a couple weeks. So he went from, like, being paralyzed, which was, you know, what was weird was when he came out of it, his arms were paralyzed, but his legs weren't. I could tell that his legs were strong, which doesn't really make any sense.
Damage to the cerebellum and the brainstem had something to do with that.
Yeah, had to. Because there was no other, like, you know.
Because those control proprioceptive movement, if I'm not mistaken, which is his ability to know exactly where his limbs are in space, which might have been what was going on with his arms. You said they're back, though, right?
They're back. He's a little, I mean, he's got some issues. He's a little shaky. He the cerebellum is what's affected when we drink.
Yeah.
So he kind of moves like, you know, he's had a few.
Yeah,
it's a balanced thing. A little shaky, a little, you know, he's never going to be an NFL quarterback, but he was never going to be an NFL quarterback anyway.
Dude, being a team guy, you know that the guy, some of our Chiefs get really good at mastering that whole drunken master,
right?
And they're exceptional at what they do. You didn't even know it. So
I mean,
don't count that out at all.
I mean, his little brain is still developing actually right now. This is the perfect opportunity to keep hammering everything.
Well, neuroplasticity, as you well know, is a thing. And the moment he could start doing stuff, I started doing stuff with him, throwing the baseball, throwing the football, boxing, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we went, you know, I got him on a bike, you know, it was a little bit before he could get on a bicycle and kind of feel that balance again. And now he's good to go. His attitude is better. He doesn't whine. He has appreciation for life. He has appreciation for all sorts of things. So when he turned 12, he got $100 from his grandmother for his birthday. You know what he did with it? He donated it to Higher Ground. What 12-year-old donates money? Donates their birthday money.
That one.
That one.
Yeah. So that was before he had an ET, you know, before he had a crike. So after that, he was intubated. He got a crike. He got a G-tube, hole in the skull, mainline, everything. He had everything going on.
I can't imagine how, well... You're right. There's something as parents, especially, you know, I'm a father, so I speak as a father. When something like this happens to your baby and it gets past your watch, that is the worst, most helpless feeling in the world. Like, yeah. I failed as a father, not only because this happened and I can't do anything. How do you rebound from that? What steps did you take, you want to share that?
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't, especially since you get a chance, you didn't lose him.
Yeah.
God, thank God.
Well, a lot of things. You know, one thing we were talking about earlier, which I don't mind talking about, is a psychedelic treatment. I mean, not that I went in there for that. I actually went in there for my childhood stuff. But it's all like an all-encompassing, make you a better human being or more aware of how you started, where you've gone, where you want to go, and everything in between.
Let's dip into that. Give me a second on this one though. Because I want people out there to hear this, because challenging times when it comes to your children affect the relationship between you and the missus.
Yeah.
Is that something that y'all absolutely went through? And if you did, how did you work that out? People look for that. People want to know. They want to hear that stuff. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say we got tighter, my wife and I. We were there the entire time. You know, one of us was in the room the entire time, those 51 days. Little side note, little tangent, was some kids don't have anybody in there. Some kids in the ICU are alone and don't have parents or anybody, and that's heartbreaking, but that's a tangent. My wife and I got tighter. We got in a couple arguments during this time frame, but, you know, every morning we were laying next to him, like, spooning on a on a couch that's meant for one, and that's, you know what I mean. So it was a tight experience. But
and fortunately enough, your extended family, they were in-laws,
very helpful.
Johnny on the spot, drop everything, lose everything. We're running. Here we go. What can we take care of Jack? And
yeah, George's best friend's mother set up a GoFundMe. I never shared it because I felt weird about it. But the GoFundMe was well funded. Navy SEAL Foundation came out to help. SEAL Legacy came out to help. The Brotherhood came out to help. So the help was all there. So you just have to kind of put your life on hold, and everything is about the kid in the hospital, and that's what you do, and that's the only thing that matters. And
gut wrenching. Because his brother, he probably didn't get it.
He still doesn't get it. And that's what, this cuts me deep. So I got two boys, 12 and 14. They're 22 months apart. They're completely, utterly different. The older one's basically like a team guy. And he's just an animal. At 7 years old, he had 2 years of boxing, 6 months of Muay Thai, 6 months of jiu-jitsu, and 6 months of wrestling. Okay? That's my older boy. So they're in wrestling, these two boys, and an older, bigger kid picks up George and smashes him down on the ground and stands over him and laughs. And Jack, my other son, comes over and he starts laughing too. And I'm like, oh my God, get over here. I take him outside, put him into the hall, and I'm like, dude, if a bigger kid picks up your brother and stands over him and laughs, you don't go over there and laugh with him. When mom and I die, your brother's the only thing you're going to have. Like, forever. This has got to change. But he still doesn't get it. He still gives him shit. And, we'll be talking and we'll talk about George almost dying. And Jack's like, whatever. And you're just like, oh my God, like, how do I get it through to this? I want to watch. You know what I was told? Sit him down and put on Boondock Saints and say, that's how brothers ought to behave with each other.
Right there.
Right?
That's what molded this one.
Yeah, we added that one to our
Wonder Twin Powers. Yeah. Activate over here.
We added that one into the.
We got molded at a young age too.
Our daddy demanded that. He's like, no matter what, at the end of the day, it's two of you.
Yeah,
your brothers, and you act
to a point to where like we don't when we're apart, it's a problem.
I heard you guys fought or competed until you were 17, and then you're like, we're not doing this anymore. Or what was that?
Oh, against each other?
Yeah.
Man.
18, August 4th, 1994 was the last time we touched each other in conflict.
How did that go? How did?
Bad, bro. We all almost went up in the hospital.
I was in the hospital.
Broken bones. It was thunder and lightning in a contained environment. Well, they thought it was contained. It wasn't.
Didn't work out all that well.
Didn't work out all that well for everybody else. But
were you always tight? Were you tight?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, what not? We didn't start that. Our dad did.
And we were best friends, inseparable, watch each other back 100% from the womb to the tomb. That's our little catchphrase. I think.
Well, I got to install that in my boys somehow. And I don't
eventually
know how to do
they'll figure it out, yeah. I think. I harp on Gunner about that all the time. I was like, this is your baby brother. By all means, if somebody's jacking with him, you're jacking with him too.
And I always appreciated
jacking the guy up.
It's like when you split twins, when you pull them apart, like there is a certain point where they were connected, and that part is what we get along. And then there's the opposite ends, and that's what I love about his side, left side, right side, back to back. You know, this that whole dominant thing, and instead of getting upset about it, learn to appreciate it. That's what we did.
You don't have any brothers, do you?
I do. I've got three. Well, I've got five half brothers. I've got one full sister, two half sisters, three half brothers, and then
Lord.
Years after my dad died, I found out I have two other half brothers. I haven't even looked up yet.
Why is that such a thing? That's your brothers. You know what I mean? Like you got it's. I mean that's.
Well, I think I'm a third. I think one day he'll see a set of brothers defending each other, or something, or he's gonna come. And help him.
Yeah.
And then the light bulb is going to go off. Yeah.
That's usually
how it works. Does Jack have any like
frustrations or resentment from the time that y'all spent in the hospital with him over?
Yeah, because it made everything about George.
Yeah.
You know, he, first of all, an older brother doesn't want normally a younger brother to be born anyway.
Sure.
You want to be like, the only child. And then this kid comes along and all the love is going to him. And you're like, what the? So, you know, that just has never changed. And he got all the attention. Jack was kind of back home and being attended to, but it hasn't hit him yet. You can talk to him and you know that there's no cognitive, like, my brother almost died. Like, this is a big deal.
That may be a good or a bad thing. I don't know.
I was about to say, you kind of stretch it out when it's like a aha moment or a realization as to what that truly was. And that in itself, like us, we go on that anger and chaos so far so we can appreciate it on the other end. What the other side's like. That's the only way we can know true joy and happiness is if we know how pure bad pain it sucks and chaos. And,
yeah.
That's it. And you can tell somebody's been deep down into it because of how joyful they are on the back end. First 40 years are in darkness. Like, you're just trying to figure out the man you're not and the life that you're not supposed to. It's all build up. And then when something like that sets it, you push forward.
So almost losing your, I can't imagine, you know, having to go through as long as you and Cassie had to go through that. Just from the time you're in the service to your childhood, now to this, it's a life of aggression, trauma. I'm not taking away the fact that there was an awesome elation and great times and that, but it seems guys that like you in your situation, we have a tendency to shoulder a lot more. And once we exit the service and continue on life, it's really hard to make the transition. But you took a journey that you were mentioning about, you were talking about earlier. You mind sharing?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think I want to clear up a misconception people have about what you're about to talk about. And because I took a journey too. And you and I have chatted about this and we're on the same page. There's a way out of the emotional struggle, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So the first thing I'll say is I successfully compartmentalized everything for most of my life, like most team guys, right? Don't touch it. Don't go there. I'm not going there. Period.
Repress.
Yeah, that works, but it's not sustainable. It's almost like you have an open wound, an open infected wound that you're just putting a Band-Aid over. And until you go into it, until you dig into it, it's going to be an infected wound. So all my trauma that I experienced, and my stuff is childhood. Like, I don't even consider war stuff to be my stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
my stuff is childhood. So anyway, I used to just put that in a box and lock it away and never talk about it. But then I started to be vulnerable and I started to understand the power of vulnerability and how it's disarming and it allows other people to open up. And not everybody wants a big bad dude pounding on their chest. They want some vulnerability. So anyway, I had this vulnerability kind of transition. I started working through my stuff. I was really into disclosure or discovery and disclosure, which basically means like look at your shit and go through your shit and then voice it. Like, so for somebody that didn't voice anything and compartmentalized everything, voicing it and getting off your chest was very cathartic to me. So fast forward until January when I heard about this psychedelic treatment, and it's put on by a doctor. And sometimes it's funded by another organization, and you go down to New Mexico and you consume a couple plant-based medicines and natural medicines, the first being Ibogaine, right? So this is a plant-based medicine from the Iboga tree, and it's DMT, and you consume it, and then you're basically in a state of... the cool thing about it is you're totally cognizant. You're totally with it. You're not drunk. You're not high. Like, you're not off into space, you have your wherewithal and you're in a dream state. At least that's the way it's explained to me. So, and it's harsh. It's not a party drug. This is never going to be a party drug because it's a harsh experience because you are going through your shit. And the first time I did it, it didn't even work. But when I was there, this one guy had an amazing experience that I want to talk about. He was a Force Recon guy. There was like a couple SEALs and a Force Recon guy. The Force Recon guy does the Ibogaine, and all of a sudden he's in this room And he's in a room with the presence, and the presence starts ripping stuff off the wall. And it's like, you see these suicidal thoughts you've had since you were 10 years old? You don't need those anymore. You see this shame that you felt since you were 7 years old? You don't need that anymore. And it just went around the room, and it picked off all of his shit, all of his baggage, all of his trauma, and explained to him and showed to him why it's not useful to him anymore. And I was like, wow, that's like, that could, that's like 10 years of therapy in like 10 hours.
Can you explain what you mean when the medicine explains something to you? Because people don't understand that. It may be to a point where people are not going to get it because unless you experience or take a journey. Yeah. But
so before the journey, it's very intentional. You have these books that you work through, and you work through these intentionalities. And whether you're into God or spirituality, or I liked the idea of asking my future wiser self questions, but basically you ask questions to the medicine or in your head, and it comes back with answers that you probably are not going to come up with on your own. And you ask it things, and you ask it to show you things, and it will show you things. So for example, here's a cool thing about it. And I was talking about how you're totally sane and sober, but you're also in a dream state. Like, you have your eyes closed and you have these sleeping shades on your eyes, but you are seeing perfect images, like HD images with your eyes closed. Like, that's how cool it is, because you're accessing that dream state. So you ask it things. You ask it why was my whatever your shit is, you ask it that, and it will come back to you, and it will give you answers, and it will kind of guide you through your shit, guide you through what you need to be guided through. So I've done that twice. The first time didn't work. The second time did work. And the second time I did Ibogaine, I got a compliment from my dad, which is what my life probably would have been different if I would have just gotten this compliment from him. He was a guy that complimented me like twice in my entire life. I forgot the first one, and the second one was I finished Buds. And I walked away with it with just exactly what I needed to hear from him from that experience, right? So Ibogaine, therapy, not a party drug, really harsh, will make you go through your trauma, and normally you come out the other side better. Then you chill out. That's a Friday night. Saturday, you kind of chill and just eat fruit. Sunday is 5-MeO-DMT. So the first one, by the way, Ibogaine, is called the Stern Father, which is perfect, right? The Stern Father. The second one is the God molecule. So 5-MeO-DMT is the God molecule. And that is unlike anything else on this planet, period, times a trillion. You can't even explain it with words. So the first time I did, and I'm about to explain it with words, but I think you get what I mean. The first time I did it, I met God, and I'm not even a Christian. Because of that, I now believe in God. I'm not sure what I think about religion and the brands of religion, but I believe in God, and I'm a God-fearing man. The first time I did this 5-MeO, I felt love. I felt love to the cellular level. I met this big ball of light and love, which I think was God, and the healer said, you were laying there, and you got this giant smile on your face, and you're like, it's all about love. And like, that's not something I say. That's not something I think. Like, I'm not a big ball of love, you know? So anyway, that experience changed me. Was doing pretty good for a while. And then, you know, basically I went there because I was having suicidal thoughts. I've had a lot of suicidal thoughts. I have no plan, no desire to die or plan to do so. But I've pretty much wanted to die since I was like 6 or maybe 12. I don't really know, because of my childhood. So fast forward to the next time I did 5-MeO, I got to die, and I got to do that without putting anybody else through it, and then was reborn, and like basically came back and was like, wow, like I'm okay now. I like my anger, I don't need that. It's not helpful. The trauma, all that stuff that I've experienced, the shame, the betrayal, the pain, whatever your pain is, it's not useful. It's like a bag of bricks. You just set that down and walk away, right? So it was a game changer. So yeah, 5-MeO-DMT, I would suggest every human being on the planet experience it, and it's unlike anything else times a million.
Because the medicine has the ability to put it into a perspective that only you will understand.
Great way to phrase it.
And it's 20 years of therapy in 3 days that you don't have to talk to somebody you don't know who has no emotional or relationship tie into you as an individual?
So you have actually have a built-in therapist that it, and that's the access to the door.
Well, that's what's cool is everything we need is in us already.
Absolutely.
It's already programmed in there.
We don't, you know what I mean? Like throughout our lives, everything you guys, us, whatever we need to do, we can do. It's on the inside. It's not external. I mean, you might say like this plant-based medicine is the external part of it because you're not going there without it. But in terms, you don't need a therapist. You don't need to be uncomfortable and divulge your, you know, X, Y, and Z to a guy if this works for you.
So I would assume that beforehand there were things in your life with your relationship, with your wife, your kids, your family that you didn't have a perspective on. But after your journey, did all that change? Is it, what's it like now on the other side when you're present and looking around?
Yeah, well, that's another good point is being present, and presence is a whole nother tangent. What I realized was I'd never had an issue being present when I was doing something, shooting, jumping out of an aircraft, scuba diving, whatever it is, I am present. But with like conversation and relationships and other humans, I wasn't present. I was always like thinking about what I was going to say next and not listening to the person. I was always thinking about what I was going to do next and not really trying to like form relationships. So like communication and relationships in general to me is like new or pretty new. And that experience, well, that experience, but the 5-MeO experience, buffed that up. And now I want to help people. I don't want to hurt people. Like I want to come from a place of love and not anger. You know, I want good things and I want people to experience good things. And, as opposed to the older me that like to elbow people in the face and choke them out and fist fight and you know what I mean? So it's more of a hippie, like more of a lovey-dovey hippie type than a freaking angry destroyer.
Or a dad.
Hmm?
A father, a dad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Those make better fathers than...
Is this a self-guided experience or a facilitated experience?
Facilitated. Yeah, you get a shaman or a healer assigned to you. You talk with him or her beforehand, and they sort of give you the deal. Tell you, keep your expectations lower. Don't even have any expectations other than setting your intentions, what you want to get from the experience. And then you can always, you know, those people are on site. You're very well taken care of. There's other doctors and nurses.
Yeah,
there's doctors and nurses, and more importantly, other team guys there. Because you're laying, picture yourself, it's a nice house, but picture a bunch of mattresses on the floor and 4 to 6 dudes just like laying on the floor. Like out of it.
But you were very well protected.
That's the thing is you've got other team guys there, guides that are there and sober and staying there and you know.
That recon, Bubba, what his experience I'm sure was just life altering.
Yes, totally. He had a crazy story. I actually just did a podcast with him. I haven't put it up yet, but yeah, you'll hear that I'll send it to you.
What did it do for the family, wife and kids? When you came home.
Yeah, it's been super helpful. They like me a lot more than, you know.
I would assume now you're approachable.
I'm much more approachable. I'm way less intense. I don't get angry as often or as easy.
And when you say that, I'm sure there's going to be people out there that say, well, I need to be that way. And the answer to that is you still can be.
Yeah.
You just don't have to be right now.
When you need it.
When you need it.
Yeah.
More control.
Well, that's like switching on and off.
It's not control. It's more of a, I said presence already, but it's more of an understanding of, I don't have to be a team guy. I need to be a daddy. I need to be a citizen in the community. So literally just turning the page and starting a new chapter and being okay with it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you got situational awareness and then you have hypervigilance. Like we should all be situationally aware. But should we all be hypervigilant and watching over our shoulders at all times? No, because that's you don't need that. That's putting your mind in a state of stress that you don't need. But the stuff that made us good team guys and kept us alive, that's great. And it had a use. It can have a use if it pops up in the future. But you don't want to roll around your whole life like that, right? Like when you're on target in Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, doing what you do, that's wonderful. That keeps you alive. You're kicking ass. But that's not how you speak to your kids and your wife and your mother-in-law. And you know what I mean? It's like, that's useful. It kept you alive, but it's not how you want to roll forever.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go back to it. You know?
It's
right. Some guy comes and smacks my wife on the ass or pushes my little kid. Like shit's going to go down.
That's when you're like, thank you.
Ta-da. Those are those mindscapes I have now. Like, I'll be standing next to, walking in the living room or something, step on a Lego, or the kids will be, and I'll ask something for the kids. And dad's like, hey, kind of joking around. The minute they say something I don't want to hear, I have this in my head where I shift over to the UDTs and the blue shirt with the handlebar,
yeah,
megaphone. Get up and get up. That kind of thing. But it's it is fun to have it captured in there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is it something you can roll to?
Well, that kind of brings up empathy too. So I left the teams with basically no empathy and no humility. And empathy, you know, that back to the girl with Down syndrome or Special Olympics or whatever, empathy is an important thing in life. And, you know, we don't learn that in the teams. There's no use for empathy as a team guy, right? You don't want to empathy. Who gives a shit? You don't want to empathize with anybody else. You want to freaking kill him, choke him out, beat him up, whatever you want to do. But I think empathy and humility are important in life and important in leadership. And I picked them up pretty late, like probably mid-30s. You know, I didn't have either one of those until pretty recently. But important stuff for family life.
That's what I learned during COVID was to embrace the moment. Because just like you said, it's not that I wasn't enjoying what we were doing, but I would always jump ahead to the next moment and start concentrating on that when the end part is the best, right?
That's why you're successful. You don't rest on your laurels. Right. Who wants to be stagnant? Right.
Right. And it has nothing to do. That's what we think. But in reality, you're
missing out on the greatest pieces.
Yeah. You shorten down the prep. Like, we're already ready. We're just, you know, when the moment shows up, then we'll engage. And that forward thinking, it's just kind of, and they teach us that. Look forward with it.
It's hard to be, in my opinion, it's hard to be a journey guy. And it's easy to be a destination guy. Like, we always think about the destination, the goal, the mission. But I don't know about you guys, but I rarely enjoyed myself in the moment. Because I'm always thinking about that next thing and mm-hmm. what I got to do here. I'm not thinking about, oh, you did a good job on that. You're thinking about, oh, I got to get better on that.
Stop and smell the roses, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. That's I got to tell you, buddy, especially with somebody with your background, just sharing something like that means more to all of us than you know. Because a lot of people that have been through these things, they don't have a perspective on the other side. They're locked into the sheer agony of the moment, and they need to hear guys like you that have gone through something like that. They can say, "Hey, look, yeah, this happened to me, but it doesn't define me."
Yeah,
and keep moving forward. So God bless you, and God bless your family, man. I'm glad to see how's he. He's thriving now. Yeah,
he's doing well. Yeah, he's doing well. He's he's got an entrepreneurial mind.
I don't got any more.
He's always wanting to flip something. He's like, let's buy a go-kart, fix it up, and flip it. And, so I just threw that.
Nice skinny shirt.
Yeah, just for fun.
Little tactical unicorn. Never take yourself too seriously. That's how I roll. And in terms of, you guys are probably going to ask what I'm doing next or what I'm, what's next in my life.
What's on the horizon?
The 1 Mile Project. I don't know if you heard of the 1 Mile Project.
Uh-huh.
It's started by a couple of civilians. It's a nonprofit. And we've got a race coming up, Race Across America in June.
Well, like a foot race?
Bicycles.
Okay.
Eight-person bicycle race. I'm on the crew. I'm not biking. I'm going to be a motivator. But we start, and I think Carl's...
Good for you.
Yeah.
I mean...
I don't want to sit on 3,000 bikes.
Yeah. Different breed of people.
So we got an 8-man team, and some of them are like amputees. And, you know, we've got like a range of like Olympic caliber athletes and like veteran amputees. We're not trying to win, but we're gonna ride across America. So we start in like Carlsbad, California. I think it's like third week of June. And we're gonna break it up, I think, 12 on, 12 off. So I got four riders. They're gonna do 15 minutes on. So they're gonna be sprinting across the whole damn country.
Damn.
15 minutes on, 15, 15, and then you're back at it for 12 hours. And it takes like 9 or 10 days to bike across America to bring light and help those suffering in silence. So it's
you guys riding up north where it's cooler?
Yeah, where y'all going? Y'all have layup positions?
No, and you gain a shitload of elevation too. It's like basically the middle of the country, like through the mountains.
Oh, you're hitting the mountains. Awesome.
You hit the mountains.
Sweet.
And yeah, man, one mile, that's my next thing, and looking forward to it. We go out in February, go out and do our first little training op in Carlsbad and meet all the people involved. And yeah.
Outstanding.
What about social media?
Social media, I'm kind of a train wreck. I just deleted Facebook about 3 weeks ago, and I actually just brought it back up today. I've got like 1 foot in of social media, 1 foot out. Like, I'm not consistent. I barely like it. I barely want to put myself out there, and So, what's interesting about this being here, I think you guys will just see me trend up because I haven't been putting much effort into.
No, we're happy to help
you. Into helping myself or marketing myself at all. Like, I got my own podcast, and I haven't even tried to monetize it yet. The Full Monty. There's two Full Monty podcasts out there. Oh, bring up the one pick, the naked whip pick.
Oh, it's up here.
I got an 18. Here's my only 18 Delta pick. Right there. Okay. That's 18 Delta, me naked
in a crowded parking lot
with the sun up, cracking a whip. And if you the Full Monty, my logo is basically my silhouette. So that in all black. Why not, right?
You have amazing shoulders.
There's a Chrysler in the background.
Hey, Monty's also a part of the Team Never Quit Speakers Bureau. So if you guys are
wanting to book
some Monty, teamneverquit.com/speakers.
Yeah, MontyHeath.com and all the social medias. I'm there, just my name, Monty Heath. And
thanks for joining us today,
brother.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks for coming out to Valhalla and Team Never Quit.
I feel at home. This place is awesome.
This is first round in the team room, bro. So
thank you guys for listening to this episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. Let us know what you think. We're available anywhere you get your podcast, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox, and more. We got brand new podcast gear, Never Quit flags, all kind of stuff in the shop. Head over to shop.teamneverquit.com. Make sure to leave us a review on iTunes. Let us know what you think. See you guys next week.